Boat Trader, America's largest boating marketplace, offering easy financing and over 100,000 boat listings to choose from. Sell, find, and finance new or used boats on America's largest boating marketplace. Visit BoatTrader.com to get started.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Mobile hunters, are you looking to make the move to saddle hunting this year? Or maybe you just want to add a few new pieces of gear or upgrade your current saddle gear. If that's the case, then head over to TetheredNation.com where they've got all mobile hunters covered. Whether you're new to saddle hunting or an old timer, Tethered is your one-stop saddle shop. From saddles to ropes, sticks, ascenders, whatever it is you need, they have you covered. I've personally been using their gear for the past three seasons. Now my base setup consists of the Phantom Saddle and the Predator platform. And if you're wondering why I've chosen to use their gear above all else, here's the cliff notes. They're innovative and pushing the mobile hunting forward overall. They cut no corners and prioritize the safety and performance of their gear. They care about the community that they've created, and their gear allows me to hunt free. And above all else, I like to support good people doing good work. If you're interested in upping your mobile hunting game, then head to TetheredNation.com. This podcast is brought to you by Skull Brew Coffee Company. Skull Brew Coffee roasts premium single origin coffee, guaranteeing to deliver the freshest coffee directly to your doorstep. The kicker? They're 2% for conservation certified and donate 10% of their proceeds back to organizations who support the interests of our hunting community. So go to skullbrewcoffee.com and pick up one of their 3 killer roasts and fuel your hunt and fill more tags with Skull Brew Coffee. Welcome to the Truth from the Stand Deer Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Skull Brew Coffee Company. I'm your host, Clint Campbell, and you're listening to episode number 230. Today, we're talking Eastern Pennsylvania Big Woods bow hunting, so stay tuned. What is up, everyone? Happy Wednesday to you. Hope you are doing well. Hope you are feeling fine. Hope your turkey dreams are coming true. I had a pretty cool weekend. Nothing crazy hunting related, but I was able to kind of get out and shoot my bow more than I've been able to in the past several weeks, which has been awesome. Physical therapy seems to be working. So I actually went out, and this will be coming soon, so I guess keep an eye out for on the YouTube channel, but I headed over to a buddy of ours, archery shop, Bob and AJ's here. That's near where I live. It's kind of my hometown archery shop. My buddy Wilson works there. So I headed over there and had been wanting to do a bow review video and shoot a bunch of new bows. But unfortunately, shoulder injury, not able to shoot, stuff like that. So I had to kind of put it off. I was hoping to do it earlier in the spring or in late winter. So finally got a chance to go over to the shop this weekend and shot a bunch of bows, reviewed them. And then Wilson kind of talked about the specs of them and setups and some of the things that are unique for each bow or each flagship bow this year. I took a look at, shot a Prime, shot an Elite, shot the new Matthews, and shot a Bowtech. So not going to give it away as far as like what my preferences were. Just keep your eyes peeled for the video that'll come out and be sure to check that out. Have a cool show today, but before we jump into it, I just want to do a couple quick upfront things to get out of the way. Exodus, our buddies over at Exodus Outdoor Gear, might have something interesting coming up that you guys are going to want to pay attention to. They might have a little something something for the listeners, a little something something for those who are trail camera fans. So I'd be sure to pay attention to this podcast, pay attention to their Instagram channel and what they've got going on their YouTube channel and stuff like that, to get the deets for the things that might be coming up. So stay on the lookout for that. And then, as always, be sure to head over to the skullbrewcoffee.com and pick yourself up some killer coffee. So with that, have a cool show today after we get all that housekeeping out of the way. I have on today. Today's a kind of a unique show. It's a little bit of a selfish show, if I'm being quite honest with you. You know, as you guys have heard, if you listen to this podcast, I've been venturing out to some different places, doing some scouting in some big woods and in the PA area. And, you know, was really kind of throwing a dart at a dartboard to a degree and going out and scouting and started to find some sign and things of that nature. You know, I talked about that extensively in a previous podcast with my buddy Aaron Hepler when we went out to scout. But I wasn't real sure about the area because I didn't really know the sign that I was seeing, you know, its relationship to the caliber of deer or quality of deer or whatever the case is. And so, you know, had a fellow reach out to me who has some familiarity with that area or with an area that I was kind of looking at in general, and had some information for me to kind of help, you know, confirm some of the things that I thought that I thought was true, which was nice. And so I wanted to have this fellow on. His name is Tom Runscavage. He's from northeastern Pennsylvania, and he's hunted in the general area of which I'm kind of looking, which is tons and tons of public land up there. And so I wanted to have him on, one, selfishly to pick his brain a little bit to see if I could get some, you know, learn a little bit more about the area and what I'm looking at and how the deer kind of use terrain and, you know, what types of things he's looking for specifically in that area that might be different than what I'm looking for in the areas that, that I hunt, and maybe some things that are different from other big woods areas that I've hunted. So had Tom on, had a really cool conversation around what it's like to hunt in the, in northeastern Pennsylvania in the big woods. He also has done some DIY, solo hunts out in the West, for elk, and I'm forgetting where it was one, I think mule deer as well, which is super awesome. I mean, you know, doing those solo hunts, I'll do a fair amount of those travel hunts and stuff like that for whitetails. Doing a solo hunt out West in that big country like that is a whole different ball game, in my opinion. And he did that and got it done on a good mule deer the one year, and had, some close opportunities on his elk hunt as well. And so we talk about that a little bit, but the bulk of the conversation is really around the big woods in northeastern Pennsylvania and what he's used and has found to help him be successful. Not just that, but he killed a hell of a deer last year. That was just, it's just an awesome buck. And we get the story on that. And when you kind of hear that, you know, I would, if you've not listened to the Nathan Keelan episodes that I've done just a few weeks ago, I would maybe listen to those and then listen to this episode, because some of what he talks about whenever he killed that good buck last year, if you listen to the Nathan Keelan episodes, you'll start to see some similarities, and it'll start to make sense as to how his hunt came together and kind of why it came together. So with that, I'm not going to give anything else away. I'll let you guys kind of dive into the episode. But first, as always, I want to thank you all for listening. All right, folks, welcome back to another episode of the Truth from the Stand Deer Hunting Podcast. And today I have on a gentleman. He is a brother of the Keystone State deer hunter, outdoorsman. I'm talking to my buddy, my new buddy. Man, that's the one thing, like, social media is terrible for almost everything except meeting cool people that I like to connect with that also hunt. And I have on the phone with me Tom Runscavage. And I think I said your name right this time.
Oh, yeah, perfect.
Nice. How you doing, man? You doing all right?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. Just enjoying the kind of spring weather that we're starting to get here in PA.
I know, right, man? It's this year we're actually getting a little bit of spring, man. It seems like more and more it goes straight from winter to summer, and we kind of skip spring.
Yeah,
you know, go ahead.
I see the last few years we've had almost like monsoon season. So you have winter monsoon season, and then it gets to 70 to 80 degrees out, summertime weather.
Yeah, I know.
So we're not getting as much rain, thankfully.
I know, right? But I will say this, we got a pile of snow there at the end of the year, and it kind of put a pretty big hurting on my scouting plans right at the end of, I guess, February or whatever, whenever I really like to try to start hitting it hard. It was a no go. And I know up in your neck of the woods, I know you guys got pounded with snow. So I'm sure you kind of got a late start to your scouting too, it seems, right?
Yeah, it was pretty late, unfortunately, but the woods are starting to green up a little bit, but still getting out and getting some scouting in done before that happens.
Nice. Well, I'm sitting here having a glass of bourbon and looking forward to the chat, because I know, you know, we are familiar with some similar areas, but I do have to bring up the fact that I'm drinking a bourbon and you might be drinking a Truly. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, you could say there is truth to that. It's actually, it's a truly the peach tea flavor, actually. So I actually just got back from Florida yesterday, so it was the only thing I had left in my my beer fridge down my basement. So I'll have to restock with some better stuff next time.
All right, we'll let it slide since you just got back from vacation, because like, that's a perfectly fine beach drink. So we'll let it go. We'll let it go this time, man. But Tom, before we jump into things, man, we're gonna talk a bunch of deer hunting and pick your brain about some new kind of areas and stuff like that that have been intriguing me for a little while. But before we do all that, if you wouldn't mind, just, you know, let people know where you're from and what you do for a living, a little bit of background about yourself.
Yeah. So my name is Tom Renskavage. I live here in Northeast Pennsylvania, kind of outside the Wilkes-Barre area. I work in a hospital. I'm a nurse practitioner. I've been hunting since I was 12 years old, mainly kind of like the traditional PA style, like rifle hunting with the dad, the uncles, the grandfather. And I started getting kind of hardcore into archery hunting about 7 years ago. So ever since then, it's been archery pretty much 24/7 on my mind. So That's what I like doing the best.
Right. And once that bug bites you, man, it's pretty much all downhill from there, right?
Oh, it really is. Yeah. And the bank account definitely takes a hurting too. I can't really afford any more hobbies.
I hear that, man. My wife's kind of the same way. She's like, if you start another hobby, she's like, something's got to go. She's like, cause you got too many and they're too costly. So the archery one that's sticking around, cause I got this canoe or not a canoe. I got a kayak to get into some water access places. And my idea was, I was like, well, got the kayak. I was like, you know, maybe I'll start fishing. You know, and she was just like, yeah. She's like, nah, she's like, you can get yourself a fishing pole and go out and like get the line wet if you want to. But she's like, we're not going to go the route of archery for fishing. She's like, that's not going to happen. So
I think the double kayak, that way you can bring her out too. And then it's kind of a joint gift.
Well, see, that's
maybe
how
you can get like a double crossbow.
Right. That's how I kind of initially got into the kayak, because it is big enough for two. And I got a second seat for my daughter, because I was like, my daughter she's not really into hunting, but she does like to fish, you know? So I was like, okay. All right. I was like, I'll, you know, get the kayak and get one that has enough room that I can get a second seat in it, you know, and take my daughter out fishing. But that's not happened to this point. It's really just a hunting rig, and I used my daughter as a ploy to buy a kayak. So that's
okay. that's fair enough.
Yeah, so that's really where that kind of netted out, man. But so you started kind of hunting like the traditional way, you know, you do in PA. Like, do you come from a hunting family, or you know, do all your uncles and grandfathers and stuff like that hunt, or was it more of just a kind of like your household, or is it more of a family tradition type thing?
Yeah, it's definitely a kind of a family tradition, and it was one of those things. I mean, I still remember taking my hunter safety class with my grandfather literally sitting next to me, and we went for pizza afterwards to celebrate. And it's kind of one of those things that, like, first day of deer season was a holiday for us. Like I said, it is for a lot of Pennsylvanians. But yeah, that's kind of how I started. And then when I got a little bit older, like high school into college, I kind of would come home and do the whole rifle hunting thing. And then once I graduated college and had a little, like, got a job and a little extra money, I'm like, well, I don't really want to just hunt 2 days or 2 weeks out of the year. So that's kind of where archery picked up for me, and kind of been a learning process ever since.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of my favorite things about it is that, you know, I mean, any type of hunting, like, you're always kind of learning something, right? But there's just something about, you know, doing it with archery equipment that, I mean, that you have to get close, and it's more intimate, and it's up close and personal. And you're usually like, if you're in it, like, you're really in it, you know, you're like, if you're in the spot, like, you're up in the business, you know? And that's typically when you find, you know, most of your success is you do your homework, and your setups are really, you know, if they pop, you know, and you get in action, it's like, man, you're counting those hairs, you know what I mean?
On stuff that's
walking by you, you know, which is always kind of cool and exciting. But man, nurse practitioner, dude. So you're like the second fellow that I know that is in that space. I don't know if you know Aaron Hepler, a buddy of mine, but,
Yeah. We actually started talking a few weeks ago. He seems a really nice guy, and he's also a nurse too. So we have that in common. We've been talking about.
Yeah. I'm envious, man. It sounds like you guys have like the primo schedule for hunting. Do you kind of, I know he has like, he'll work, you know, whatever it is, three days or whatever the case is, and then maybe have like four off because he works like three super long shifts. Is it kind of the same for you and work out well for hunting season, or you just have a ton of time to get into the timber?
Yeah. So how I'm what's called like a hospitalist. So I work in the hospital like on the daily basis. And we kind of do shift work. When I was a nurse, we would do like the 3 12-hour shifts, but now I actually do, I do 7 12-hour shifts in a row, but then I'm off for 7 days.
Oh man.
So yeah. So every other week I have a week off. So it's ideal for hunting.
Yeah. Season. You get a prime week off without having to take any vacation time during the rut. You're either getting to take a vacation.
Yeah. And if I do take a vacation week, I'll be off for 3 weeks. So it's awesome.
Yeah. And even if you don't, you're probably either catching the front side of it or the back side of it, right? That's kind of probably how it works out, right? Like you're either probably catching right around Halloween or that second week of November.
Yeah. Like I said, I always check I've already looked and kind of mapped out my schedule. I'm off the first week of November, but unfortunately it's kind of Halloween is my week on of work this year, but right. I kind of like the first week of November anyway here in PA better. So
yeah. So that's interesting. So like where you're at, like what's the, is when you see the most activity, or is it, you know, cause I've seen it in different places, right? Like in some places I've seen, you know, I'll give you for example, some of the spots around here that I hunt, you know, what I've noticed from running trail cameras and stuff like that is just, man, like that classic 28th, 29th, 30th and 31st, like get out of here. Like it's going to blow up. And then it kind of dies down, you know, right after probably like the first or the second. And it really kind of is a bust for like a little while, you know, and then it really picks up probably like around the 8th, 9th, 10th time frame is what I've kind of seen. And it's also kind of holds true, you know, whenever I go back in like Western PA, I haven't hunted my dad's place in several years, but I always run cameras for him. And so I always pull in every year to kind of check. And it's always, you know, his area or like his property really kind of pops off like anywhere after like the second through like the sixth or seventh is really like when the action happens back there. So is it that first week where you're at? Is that what you've noticed is it really kind of pops off, or is like, how's the action like the week prior?
Yeah, I mean, I've tried. I mean, I'll take off time if my year happens to fall on Halloween when I'm working, and I'm like I said, I'm always trying to have that Halloween action, but I just for some reason never do get into it. I mean, the days that I see the most activity and from trail cameras in the past, that 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th is kind of like that's the golden days around where I usually hunt at. And even if I'm actually 2 years ago I was in Colorado on a mule deer hunt, and my buddy sending me videos of the buck I was after running across the road. Cause he kind of lives by the one spot that I hunt. And that was, I think on November 5th. And then I tagged that, I think November 6th in Colorado. I come home, I check my cameras like the next week. And I had, I think out of two or three of my cameras, I had nice, like 3-year-old buck that were cruising like 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning. So it was
nice.
I mean, thankfully I tagged out in Colorado, or else I'd be a little upset that I missed all the action at home.
Right, right. Yeah, that was kind of my deal this year. It was like I literally had a cell camera in a spot that I had a hammer deer that I was trying to kill. And I was leaving for 2 weeks to go to Missouri and then Ohio. And so I couldn't take off like the 30th and the 31st. Like I just couldn't take any time off. And actually, because I had so much stuff I had to catch up on for work to get done before I left for 2 weeks, I actually had to like get on early. I was working from home, working remote and stuff like that, but I couldn't get out in the morning. Cause like the, you know, what I should have done or what I could have done potentially was, you know, get out in the morning and try to kill one, you know, and get back home before like 9:30. And honestly, it would have worked both days. I just had to sign on early because I had so much stuff to do that I had to kind of like get in early and try to get stuff done so I could get out, you know, and leave on time to get to Missouri. So I'm literally sitting here working, watching my cell camera go off with the shooter that I've been trying to kill all season. Walk by the camera twice between 7:30 and 9:30 in the morning on the 30th. And then again, between 7:30 and I think like 10 o'clock AM on the 31st. So it was like,
yeah, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that wasn't the only close like call I had with that fella. That was like I missed him by a day both times, because as you know, a PA guy, I can't hunt Sundays, so I showed up two different Saturdays to hunt him and had the same weather conditions that Sunday the day after both times, and he showed up both times in the general area that I was on, in, you know, hitting a scrape, you know, the day after I was there. So, you know, what are you gonna do, man? You know, you gotta work for a living, gotta pay the bills. But
it is what it is. Like I said, It's tough. It's a lot of it. I mean, you could be in the right place at the right time, but I think that if you don't have luck on your side, I think that's kind of the last key component of success sometimes is definitely having that luck.
Well, that's right, man. It's like, you know, there's, you know, the more I kind of done this podcast, and there's a lot that you can stack in your favor and do things right and stuff like that, but it still comes down to, you know, those things have to line up for you. You know what I mean? And it's little things like, you know, another hunter could walk through and bump a deer off his, you know, path of travel that might be coming to you, or a coyote or whatever. I mean, there's 100, you know, million different things that could happen that could change the course of that deer's, you know, how he's going to move or whatever. But so there's definitely a component of luck, but definitely tagging out in Colorado definitely makes it a little easier to watch things happening back home. So, but you know, speaking of that trip, that was a DIY kind of solo trip, wasn't it? If I'm not mistaken.
So I mean, again, like growing up, like I've always heard about my grandfather and uncles and all that saying, oh, like one day I want to go to Saskatchewan, or like, I'd love to go out west and do these things. And like I said, for a long time, I'm like, oh, like I'd love to do these hunts too. And it just didn't really seem feasible. And then I think in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, like we just see like go hunt and all this like popularity of Western hunting and how accessible it is for people to do it. So I actually have friends that from home that got married and they moved out there. So I had a place to stay, and I'd always would tell them like they don't hunt or anything. And I'd be like, oh, if you ever find anybody that does hunt, or like just maybe try to set me up with somebody. So, so they did meet like the gentleman, he, one of the people he works with, he was able to kind of give me someone's contact number, and I got in touch with him, and he was kind of telling me some of like the public that's around that area. And like, so I went out there and a third season rifle tag. He showed me around the first day, and I mean, we drove around the trucks, and like that's pretty much like what I learned the first day is there was so much road traffic just driving up and down these mountains and looking for deer. And I'm like, I mean, I didn't see anything. I'm like, I got to get away from these roads. So I hiked in to another area, like I said, not too far away from the town that I was staying in. And I was kind of like hunting back here, like just day hunts. I'd hunt all day, come back, sleep at my friend's house, and then go back out the next day and everything. And I think it was the third day of the hunt that I was just kind of, I was walking up these benches. I was in kind of like an aspen thicket, and I kicked out these two doe, and they kind of went over up to the next bench. So I followed them up there, and then I'm looking, I'm like, wait, I think I see three dark bodies, because they're, for some reason, the mule deer in this area were like, they were like black, like their color was so dark. So I pull up my scope and everything on my gun, like put my hiking stick in the snow and rest my gun on it. And I look and I just see half of a rack behind this aspen tree, and I put it right behind the shoulder. And that was only a 60-yard shot. And of course, from PA, like there's not too many places that you can shoot far. So I drove about an hour multiple times in the summer to a 200-yard range just to practice and everything. And of course, I go out there and shoot a mule deer at 60 yards like it's back here at home. So
That's funny, man.
But yeah, so, it was fun.
Nice. And so you did that trip, and then you did an elk trip too, didn't you? That was another kind of DIY trip.
Yeah. So last September, I'm like, well, I'm going to go back kind of the same area and do that again. And that time I camped out in the woods and everything and didn't have anybody with me. And like, it's tough. Like I give credit to guys, like I said, that can to go out the solo, like camp in the woods by yourself, elk hunting and everything like that. Cause it's definitely taxing on the mind.
Yeah.
Actually, like when I got out there, that it was kind of when they were getting that bad weather, that big snowstorm that hit, I think September 10th, I went out there.
Right.
And like my friends, they walked me up kind of, they hiked up with me like in the afternoon to kind of help me just get set up and everything. And they walk away and like just get that sinking feeling like, all right, like now you're by yourself, like it's snowing, like it's just kind of miserable conditions out. Like I woke up in the morning and my boots were frozen. I'm getting those on. And actually, as I left the tent and started kind of hiking up, I'm not like maybe about 300 yards up, like it was kind of just all sagebrush. And I was going into like the aspens, kind of where I shot my mule deer at the year before. And I actually bump an elk, and he kind of runs into the aspens, and I just kind of go to the edge of there, and like my heart's racing. I'm like trying to think of what to do. I blew a couple cow calls and then picked up a stick and started raking. And actually, like I still see it in my head vividly, this elk kind of coming back from the aspens and coming kind of running parallel alongside me. And he got to around, I thought it was 30 yards. It ended up being 36 yards. And he was just coming. And he was like looking right at me. And I always like, from all the YouTube videos and the podcasts I listen to about kind of how, just don't get downwind of them. Like, just stay still, try not to get downwind of, let them get your wind and everything. And where he was, there was kind of his vitals were kind of covered with some brush, and he had 10 more yards to walk and he would have been in an opening, but my wind was blowing directly that direction. So I kind of just took a shot and ended up just hitting the brush and deflecting off. But I think for going by myself and just going in an area that's definitely not like a known area, like I didn't run into another elk hunter out there and stuff, like have an encounter with an elk, I consider that a successful trip. So
Boat Trader is America's largest boating marketplace with over 100,000 boats to choose from. We offer simple, comprehensive solutions for those looking to sell, find, and finance new or used boats. Visit BoatTrader.com to get started.
Oh, heck yeah, man, especially by yourself. I mean, it's ballsy to go out west and just do it by yourself. You know what I mean? Like, in general.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, those... You know, those mountains are no joke.
No, it really isn't. And like, you know, at least that time, that was the first day of the trip. Like, I would have had help to help me pack it out, and I wasn't far in. But the next couple of days when I was back there and getting farther and farther back, like, it's just, I'm like, came to the realization, like, if I want to do elk hunt like this again, like, I need to have at least one other buddy, just for the sheer fact of, like, if I got something, like, it would take me a straight 24 hours of hiking down and back and down and back just to get all the meat out. And then I flew out there. So like, I would have had to like figure out a way of getting everything kind of processed and taken care of. And the mule deer, I figured out pretty well. I was able to kind of take most of it on the plane. And I cut the antlers down the skull plate and was able to ship that back. And that worked out well. But an elk is obviously a whole nother beast to try to
figure out how to get
home.
Yeah, try to get all that stuff back. I know when I shot that buck in Iowa, like I had them just basically ship all. I like to break my own stuff down, but I shot it on the last day and ended up having them kind of just at least debone everything and then put it on dry ice and actually just ship all the meat back to me, which wasn't as expensive as I had thought. Like it wasn't terribly expensive, so that wasn't too bad. But man, going into the Rockies kind of on your own, you know, not having elk hunted before and stuff like that's kudos to you, man, because that's tough sledding just in general, right?
Yeah,
and it's thanks. Like you gotta have some like woodsmanship and a little bit of outdoor savvy to kind of be able to do that and not lose your marbles, because it's, you know, it's one of those things where you're in completely new terrain, things look different, you don't have any really sense of like wayfinding because you don't know any of the areas, right? It's like at least whenever you're in areas you're familiar with, it's like if you get up on top of a ridge, you're like, okay, I know that's like such and such point over there, so that means this is over here, you know what I mean? You can kind of find a way to reorient yourself, but whenever you're in an area that you don't know landmarks and stuff like that, like it's hard, you know, and it can be a little bit, it can make you a little nervous, to be honest with you, you know, just
the best thing I brought with me was a set of earplugs. It was just so eerily quiet at nighttime, because here like PA you have crickets and everything. It just was like on those mountains, just dead silent. It's like, all right, like if I was going to get attacked by a mountain lion, I'd rather it be like on my tent instead of hearing it walk around outside around my tent. So,
right. It's like, I just rather it happen than know it's going to happen.
Yeah. Just take me out, like jump on the tent and get me that way. Like, I don't want to hear you walking around trying to get me that way.
Like stalking me. Yeah. I don't want to hear you stalking. Yeah. You know? Yeah. My buddy lives in Montana, and he's lived there for years now. I'm probably going on 20 years, I think. And he does a lot of like spike camp hunting on his own. He lives in Lincoln, Montana, which is like, I think if I'm not mistaken, is like the highest grizzly bear population, like density per capita, like in the US, like he's got him in his backyard. Like he'll send me pictures every now and then of like a grizzly, like walking through his backyard or whatever.
Yeah.
and he'll go out and like camp by himself for like, you know, 4 days, whatever it is, you know, he'll hike into an area where he's got good weather for a couple of days, and he'll just hike in, set up a small tent and live out there by himself for a couple of days. And I'm like, man, that's just like a, you know, I don't know, man, bears are like the one thing that it's like, you know, I'm willing to hunt those areas. I don't know that I'd be willing to do it by myself necessarily.
Yeah.
I think in that situation, I'd want the buddy system, you know?
Oh yeah, for sure. And a slower buddy to outrun. So.
Right. that is key, man. A slower buddy for sure. For sure. But I mean, it's funny, cause it's just a matter of one of those things where it's like your environment that you live in, that's not anything out of the ordinary for him. That's just normal, You know what I mean?
Yeah, what you're used to.
Yeah, it's like that. It'd be like you or I going out to deer hunt by ourselves, like where we wouldn't think anything of it. So now I'm just going to go hunt, you know, and that's how he is. He's just, you know, it's like, no, it's just there's bears and mountain lions and you just got to watch what you're doing. Don't be an idiot. And that's kind of his approach. Yep. But well, cool, man. Let's dive into some whitetail stuff now, because I wanted to pick your brain about a little bit of stuff. I know you're, you know, like you mentioned, you're from Northeast Pennsylvania, and, you know, folks that listen to this podcast know I've been kind of dipping my toe in some of the big wood settings up in that area, just kind of checking some things out. And I'm hoping to maybe get a hunt or two in this year. I'm really kind of trying to do some information gathering this year and, you know, run some cameras, and then, you know, more so probably looking toward next year, to not this coming season, but the season after, to hunt once I kind of have a sense of, like, are the areas I'm looking at, are there, you know, deer spending time there? Are they spending enough time there for me to hunt? Am I in the right spots? And once I kind of know that, mm-hmm. then start to kind of hunt the area. So I want to kind of talk about that, you know, area in general. So just give the folks listening, like, a sense of, like, in your area, what size are those parcels in general? Like, whether it could be state forest, it could be game lands. Cause I mean, I think a lot of people, especially around where I live, you know, north of Philadelphia and the burbs, you know, when you get out into the quote unquote country in this area, like, you'll have some parcels that, you know, might be 60 acres. You have some that might be 1,000 or 1,200, right? And that's about as big as you're going to get here. So what are some of the sizes of acreage in the general area where you're hunting?
So it's a good mix of everything. So kind of where I focus on hunting, it's a little bit north of where I live. And that's primarily game lands areas. Mm-hmm. And that can range anywhere. There's some of the pieces that are 1,000 acres all the way up to 40,000 acres. So there's definitely a wide variety of sizes. But in the northern part of where I'm primarily hunting, there's pieces that are 30 to 40,000 that are kind of touching and really close to each other. So right. that's a good amount of land to explore. And a little bit south of me, kind of getting more towards going down towards your way in the Philadelphia area, there's definitely other little parcels that kind of connect together,
right.
Between kind of state forest and game lands too, right. that are not as big, but definitely kind of good pieces of land to get lost in.
Right. And so it's like, when you look at that area, you, to your point, it's like, there's like some 30,000 acre pieces, 40,000, and they're not all that far from one another either. And so, like, when you think about it, it's like, you know, I was actually doing the math one day when I was looking, I was like, man, there's like in the general area, you know, within a reasonable drive, like, there's probably close to like 200,000 acres, just like in an area, you know what I mean? That you could,
oh, easily,
you know, not that you would be able to hunt it one spot in the morning and then drive to the other complete side, like the next, like for the evening hunt or whatever, it might be an hour drive, but like, you're kind of around public that whole time. You know what I mean? Like, you're really not leaving, like, being too awful far away from a public piece. And that was the one thing that I kind of was really that really interested me, just because there was so much to explore. So these areas, have you been hunting them all of your life? Or is this, you know, when you started exploring some of these bigger pieces, was that, you know, later in your hunting journey, or when did you kind of start exploring some of these really big chunks?
Yeah, so I mean, like I said, when I was growing up doing the rifle hunting and everything, that was more kind of the southern part of where I live, that were not as big woods per se, areas that I hunted. Once I got into archery, like I said, I had some pieces of private initially that I had permission to hunt in, and I killed a few deer on those pieces. But it was one of those things, I just was constantly between, like, whether it's the neighbors doing work on the land or other people that had permission to hunt, it was kind of, I was always running into people, and I was always kind of disturbed in my hunts. So that's when I started kind of venturing farther out to places that I could walk around and not see another soul anywhere that I go. So
right.
I would say probably the last like 5 to 6 years, I've kind of been slowly dabbling, with maybe the last like 3 years kind of really, really focusing in on the big woods kind of setting of where I live.
Right. And so when you started kind of exploring that stuff, like, what was your process for starting to break it down? Because people do it, you know, all different types of people do it differently, right? It's like, I got some buddies that are just like map freaks, and they're so freakishly good at maps with maps. It's like, they'll almost like be able to pinpoint where they need to be, like, on a map to a degree, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I have some buddies who it's like, you know, they'll get a general idea from the map, and then they're just going to go put hammer boots on the ground. And I know some guys that just, they're not going to need a whole lot of intel. They're just going to kind of go in and, you know, and wing it to a degree, not wing it, but, you know, they're going to go in and kind of freelance it, freestyle it and figure it out on the fly, yeah. You know? So I'm just curious, man, how did you start to break down this piece? What was kind of your approach to kind of figuring out how to hunt this big wood setting?
So to give people a little kind of picture in their head, like this, it might be, it's 40,000 acres in this piece that I hunt at. I would say, honestly, 75% of it's all kind of flat terrain. Like it's, you're in the mountains, but a lot, like I said, a lot of like what you access when you get in there to the parking lots per se are kind of at the tops of these mountains.
Yeah.
So really, like I said, initially you're kind of in these parking areas, and then like, it's a lot of beech, it's a lot of maple, it's a lot of hemlock. So there's not really, like I said, starting the hunt, the archery, and kind of you hear everyone talking like, oh, like find the oaks when they're dropping and all that. Like there are very, very few oak trees and stuff like that kind of where I'm at.
Yeah.
There are some, but like I said, it's not going to be the staple food source.
Right.
So once you kind of realize that and realize that these deer, like I said, it's a low deer density. A lot of the time they spend is just traveling and browsing. Like honestly, when I've had cameras running this summer, I'll get mainly actually all different bucks. Like I rarely get doe on camera in some of these spots, which makes me think that once the fall comes and the rut happens, like these deer are traveling long distances to find doe. So like I said, how I break it down for the most part, at least now anymore, is I look for the most diversity that I can find in a select area, whether it's there's a lot of good outcomes from the clear cuts and all that they do throughout the state of Pennsylvania and across other states, obviously, but kind of keying in on those clear cuts and kind of using those as a starting point is kind of what I've started doing in the last couple of years, and kind of really trying to figure out where these deer are calling home and kind of offers them more browse, more cover. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I start my process of breaking it down. Also the game commission, I think the game commission does a great job. I anybody that's in the state of Pennsylvania, I recommend you go on the game commission website, pull up their map, because their map's going to tell you a lot of things. They're going to tell you what roads that you can drive, when these roads are open, when they close. Mm-hmm. They're also going to tell you things like prescribed burns, when they're expected to happen, ones that have previously happened over the last few years. That's all going to be marked out. And then same thing with the clear cuts. I would pair that with Onyx to kind of just see like where these burns are happening, where these clear cuts are happening. A lot of times too, Onyx doesn't really update the clear cut set. Like if a clear cut happens, it might not be on Onyx for 2+ years.
Right.
So if you go on the Game Commission website, they'll tell you like you kind of have to explore a little bit, but if you go on the website, it'll tell you like when they've contracted out certain pieces of game lands to different companies that come in and log it. So if you kind of see, oh, like in the next month or two, they're going to be timbering 300 acres on this piece that I hunt, like go back in there and kind of explore and see where they're going to do that at, because Onyx is not going to have it on there for a year or two to even see. So right. You can kind of get a jump start in finding these new areas that are going to be kind of more attractive to deer before other people
right. Go
in and find them too.
Yeah, no, that's
I
was going to say it's 100% what I was doing. I was kind of, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head, and that goes for anywhere, like regardless of what part of PA you live in. You know, I do the same thing you do, which is I look at Onyx, I kind of get my bearings about where I might want to go, right? Where, you know, topography wise, like I'm looking at the topo saying like, all right, here's some interesting topography features I might want to check out. And then I look at the aerial to kind of get a sense of like, is there a hard edge somewhere where like where there's a transition line of habitat or something like that, that might be something I want to check out. Right. That isn't always 100% true. It's like, I've walked into places before where what I saw in the aerial didn't match what I was seeing whenever I got boots on the ground, but it's at least a good starting spot. And then the next thing I do is exactly what you said, is I go on the GameLands website, you know, on their maps, and I start looking at areas that were logged and what type of logging they did, because it'll tell you whether it was select, clear cut, like whatever the case is, and give you a sense of like what that cut looks like. Burns, it'll tell you where there's like oak flats or young oak forests and stuff like that. So you can kind of start to narrow things down. I do the same thing as you do. And then what I do, I literally take a picture of that map on my computer with my phone, and I'll drop a pin on Onyx and put that picture in there. That way I know the shape of like the cut. or I know the shape of, especially if the cut's not on Onyx, or the shape of that oak flat, you know what I mean, that I'm looking at. So I know where the edges of that stuff is. And I'll just focus my scout on those areas, you know?
Yeah. The more different colors and different things you see going on, like that's where I kind of start the process of going in there and exploring and seeing what it looks like.
Right.
And also, like I said, I've had good and bad luck with the food plots that they've put in too as well. Mm-hmm. Obviously other people are going to see that and it's going to kind of draw hunters mainly. Sure. I feel like during rifle season.
Yeah.
But like I said, now's a great time because again, you don't really have great food sources. I mean, they're browsing for everything, but like some of this clover that's popping up on some of these secluded little plots there in game lands, like if you put a camera over that, like you're going to get a good majority of the different deer that are kind of in that area per se, like at least now, like you're going to see what's growing. You're going to see like what's around you. And then from there, kind of like backtracking of where he might be at and kind of figuring out how to hunt him. Like I think those food plots, if you can find those good clover plots that they're planting and everything like that, or maintaining, whether it's mowing every year, I think those are definitely a benefit to keep an eye on.
And I agree with you. I think a lot of the pressure that's around those is certainly during gun season. The other thing is too, is that at least some of the ones that on the one piece that I was on that I found, it was probably a mile. I mean, the road that was there was plenty hikeable. I mean, they had it graded out big enough to run equipment on because they had just cut back there, right? And it was gravel and stuff like that. And I'm sure they use it probably for like some type of fire access if there was ever a fire or whatever. But I'm assuming that's kind of what that was used for. But it was still, for hunting purposes, it was still a mile walk for anyone who wanted to go hunt that, right? Whether it was rifle, archery, or whatever. And that's still a hike, right? And a lot of people aren't going to make that hike that far. And I don't care how easy the hike is. You know, statistics will show you that most deer hunters don't walk much more than a half mile from where they park.
Yeah,
like, that's just like
exactly. The biggest thing is just that the deer aren't going to come out like in the evenings because they're still going to be deer and they're going to be like they're not going to want to come out in daylight into those plots. That's the biggest thing you have to realize. Like, you have more chance of that not happening than you do another hunter coming in a mile. Right. Back while you're in there. So
So I mean, you mentioned something at the beginning, which was something that, you know, I realized when I got, you know, into an area, was that a lot of this stuff, when you think about that area of Pennsylvania, you know, is, or even if you go to Western PA, it's kind of the same, you know, whether it's Northeast or Western PA, you kind of almost, where you're at and your parking or where your access is and stuff like that, you are really kind of at the top of the mountains. And so, you know, you're almost like you're hunting mountain terrain kind of, but you're also hunting very flat, kind of almost like swamp type terrain as well.
Exactly.
So, you know, what are you looking for?
Mountain bikes are.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. No, that's why, like I said, the mountain bikes are like amazing for that kind of terrain, because I can, if I'm up top, I can just get on the mountain bike and it's relatively flat and I can travel a lot of distance quick. Just using bike systems in kind of these areas.
Right. And so what are you looking at for topography? Like when you're looking at the map, you know, and you're going to go and scout an area, maybe let's say it's like an area that's close to where you've hunted before, but there's an area that you just haven't checked out. Let's say for an example, right. And it's kind of got that flat kind of setup. You know, what are you being drawn to, you know, aside from the stuff we talked about, right. From like the perspective of like looking for diversity and stuff like that. Is there like any type of topography feature that you kind of gravitate toward in this particular area?
So sometimes you'll see it on the maps, but sometimes it's just so subtle that it's hard to really pick up. But there are little elevation changes when you get on that flat stuff. There are certain areas that like I said, I was out there today turkey hunting, and there's one spot you'll be able to see it on the map, but it's up about 30 to 40 feet kind of above the rest. And it used to be kind of an old, a deer exposure area. So they've kind of taken down the fences since. So that just gives me a little bit of that elevation that I can kind of work around and scout through it. And I saw multiple trails that are kind of just running that perimeter kind of right below the top of those areas. Okay. But if you just walk around and try to find those slight little inclines, I find that's a little bit successful. Usually they're around kind of swampy areas too. Like the bottom will be a little bit wetter, and then it'll kind of be that real thick brush that's kind of like it's good for deer walking underneath, but when you get about 4 feet tall, it's kind of that a thick brush that makes it difficult to walk through if you're a person.
Right.
We'll find a lot of that kind of habitat, and I find a lot of good deer sign just on those kind of marshy bottom areas.
Yeah. And I was also kind of running into, you know, I think what you're kind of mentioning too, is like almost like these mountaintop swamps, right? Where just like low lying areas on the top that kind of get swampy. And I was finding a bunch of mountain laurel too, that was just like gnarly thick. And I was actually finding some decent stuff there as well.
Yeah. That mountain laurel, that's where, how I killed my buck this past year. I was kind of set up real close to mountain laurel. If you can find those kind of travel routes through the mountain laurel and set up close to them, like that provides deer with perfect bedding and cover and everything like that. So
right.
Mountain laurel is definitely a good thing. And again, I think a lot of times, as you said, like most hunters aren't going to walk a mile back. If you just, even if you find a parking lot, like let's just say you find good sign, maybe 200 yards back, like I wouldn't really be opposed to not hunting it, because again, if you're hunting weekdays or even in archery season, I don't really find a lot of pressure those times. Like obviously when you get closer towards the rut, and like I said, the Halloween time, you're going to see more guys, but really, like I said, you up there, at least you have pretty much the whole place to yourself a lot of times.
Right.
At least in archery season, come rifle, it's a whole another ball game.
Right.
But then also, like I said, let's say a parking lot's up top, like then I'll try to find areas that are close by that are more hiking down the hill and try to get more of those ridges and bench systems and everything. Or let's just say the parking lot's down below, like I'll try to hike up and find areas there. And usually I find more deer sign when you kind of change that elevation, because most hunters aren't going to want to go hike up or hike down in spots.
Right. Yeah. That was the one thing I was actually going to ask you. I'm glad you mentioned that about the pressure, because my kind of hope was, you know, going north to bigger pieces, you know, and just being honest, where there's less population density too. Right. Cause like where I live, the pieces are smaller, and I'm in a suburb of Philadelphia where there's a lot of people who live in this area. So, you know, just by that, you know, by those two things alone means there's going to be maybe not as many hunters in this general area, but a lot of people, probably a fair amount of hunters, and just not a lot of places to go. Right. So you just end up jamming people onto the handful of places that there are. And that was kind of my hope, was to get up there and start to get away from people, especially as I kind of hike further back in. And I actually ran into a couple old timers when I was there on my first trip, and just kind of. What's that?
Oh, go ahead. Sorry. No, I've seen a lot of old timers hiking, but not really hunting. A lot of people like going for walks up there.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I ran into, is a couple old timers that were hiking, and I was actually getting ready to leave. And I just kind of pulled off the side, and I just asked them, I was like, "Hey, you fellas from around here?" And they said, "Yeah, they were local." And they were like, "Oh," they asked me, you know, what I was up doing. I forget what they asked me, if I was trapping or something like that. And I was like, "No," I was like, "I'm up scouting for deer." We're like, "Oh, okay." They were like, "Yeah, a lot of big ones, you know, get pulled out, you know, if you get far enough back, you know." And I was like, "Oh, that's cool." And I just said, "Hey, how's the pressure? A lot of hunters around here?" And they said, "Oh yeah, you know, a lot of gun hunting." And I was like, "Well, what about archer season?" And the guy was like, "Archer season and turkey season." He's like, "You won't see another soul."
Oh yeah. I would bet you $20 right now that if you saw more than two people while you're up there archery hunting, like that would be, I would be surprised.
Really? And are you talking
while you're hunting,
like while you're in the woods or while you're in the parking lot?
While you're in the woods. Parking lot's a different story. Right. You're going to see a lot of not really road hunters, but a lot of guys just, I don't know, maybe they just like driving around, but I always see a lot of people just kind of cruising by in their car. I don't even know if they're really just hunting or they're just like going for drives, because a lot of the road system though is kind of more the perimeter. Like you're not really, there's no real roads that travel kind of into some of these spots. Like a lot of it's just kind of on the outside. So
yeah,
really you just, even if you see another two cars in a certain spot that you're at, like you get back in there and start going towards the middle of the piece or whatever, like you're going to get away from them pretty quickly.
Right. So, I mean, do you find, I'm just curious, cause when I spent, so everything you've described is what I had seen when I was in one of these spots, just, you know, you and I were talking a little bit before we started recording, it almost reminds you a little bit of Maine, about how some areas are just kind of really wide open and you get into like these beachy areas and then you get into like some, you know, hemlocks and stuff like that. And it's just, And you'd mentioned that, you know, I didn't find a lot of oaks. I found pockets of oaks here and there, which can be great if they're dropping because it'll concentrate deer, right? But you got to time it, right? Yep. If you don't time it, then you're pretty much, you know, it's you're busted essentially, right? It's like you're there whenever they either have eaten them all or you're there before they've dropped. Or they may not, that tree or that pocket may not produce this year or whatever the case is. Mm-hmm. But one thing I was kind of noticing as I was finding sign was that it would just kind of be clustered. Like it'd be, oh, there's some sign here. And then I would walk for like what seemed like for forever and I wouldn't see anything. And then all of a sudden it'd be like, oh, there's some sign here. And it just felt like the deer in this particular piece in this area where, yes, they're transient, like where they're moving long lines of movement between, you know, whether it's bed or what in browsing, whatever the case is. But it felt like deer just kind of lived in pockets. And if you weren't in one of those pockets, you were pretty much going to be shit out of luck, you know, because it felt like they kind of congregated in those particular areas. And you might get a buck that's traveling from area to area during rut to a degree, like checking doe bedding and stuff like that. But those doe bedding pieces felt like they were like a pretty fair distance apart is how it kind of felt. Yeah. The sign was all kind of like in an area and that's where the deer were. And if you aren't there, then like you're going to see nothing is what it felt like.
Yep. So what I like to do is I know, like I said, some people do this to an extent, but if I'm walking and scouting a new piece, I mark everything, every little rub that I find, every likely, like I said, if it's a scrape, anything, droppings, I'll mark it all. Like, cause again, in these areas, you're not really finding a whole lot of sign. You're finding, like I said, these pockets of sign. So those pockets of sign, like that's where I'll usually kind of run a cluster of cameras when I do kind of identify that pocket. Like maybe I'll put three cameras maybe like a 75 to 100 yard radius kind of around these different areas, different trails to see what's coming into them. But like I said, if you mark all of this stuff and just when you're at home the next few weeks, just look at this, you can see kind of where all the action's happening. Like you can identify where they're kind of possibly where they're likely bedding at. I mean, up there it's hard because I feel like bedding is kind of all over the place and it's not really like a one centralized spot. But if you can kind of start putting the pieces together, I think that's helpful. So I usually just mark everything that I find and I'll change the colors throughout the year so I can kind of see kind of historical trends of what I'm finding regarding that kind of sign that I'm locating.
Yeah. And that was what I was doing. Like as we were finding sign, I was marking it. And then when I went back and looked at it, I kind of figured out how, like, so I found some rubs that looked very consistent. Right. They looked like they were made by a deer. Right. And found some scrapes. And then ultimately ended up finding a small rub line. When I say a small rub line, it wasn't like the rubs were like super small. I mean, they weren't knock your socks off. And that was the other thing that was getting a little bit like confusing or not confusing. Cause I just didn't have a frame of reference until you and I started talking. Cause there's been some big woods pieces that I've hunted where I know the caliber of deer that are in there based on trail camera. And you look at the sign, it doesn't match the deer. You know what I mean? And I didn't know if this was one of these spots where it's like, is like the sign just going to be minuscule or am I just not in the right spot? And when you and I started talking, you're like, yeah, there's not, you're going to rarely find that like knock your socks off rub that's like neck high and just torn up. Like that's just not, you're probably not going to find a lot of that. And essentially when you and I were talking, you're like, what you are finding, it was like, was the good stuff. And I ended up following this rub line out to a buck bed that was below a clear cut. It was like classic, like right below the clear cut, you know, of does, probably rut bedding is what I'm guessing. And when I went back and kind of pieced like the beds that I found together, the buck bed that I found, the rubs that I found, the scrapes that I found, I was like, well, this is how he's working. Like, this is how he's moving through here. This is how he's getting through to check these two different doe bedding areas. And this is how his route of travel connecting these things. And so you're right. It was like, just, and I didn't even think to do it. It was just one of those things where it was a new area. So I was marking like whatever I had found. And I was like, here's his movement. This is how he's doing this. You know, now I just have to figure out like what time of year that was essentially. Right. Like, is it late October? Is it first week, November? Cause I'm imagining these guys travel a fair amount of ground. So getting on some type of, you know, rut pattern is probably non-existent. Is that kind of what you've experienced to where it's like, you know, in smaller parcels, you might get like a 3-day loop that a buck does where you're like, oh, he's going to hit this scrape every 3 days. my experience has been in some of these big woods pieces, it's like he might hit that scrape twice in like 2 days, and then you may not see him again for 10 days on that scrape.
Yeah, like I don't think like it's tough. I've always, like I said, growing up here, trying to figure out these things, because it's not what you read about or hear about. Like it's just a little bit different. Whether it's just I'm still kind of learning on my own as well, but I just never really see a consistent like 3 day pattern, 4 day pattern, anything like that. Like I will get the same deer coming by maybe once every week, sometimes maybe every 3 days, sometimes every 2 weeks. Like it's just so sporadic. It's hard to really kind of say why they're doing it when they do, and kind of putting the pieces together. Like I said, in that buck that I got a picture of that I was telling you about when I was in Colorado, like I only got a picture of this guy one time, and actually it was a 3-frame photo. It was a photo first of a doe running by. I think it was a minute or two later, I have a little 4-pointer walking by with his tongue out. And then 5 minutes after that, I had this tank 8-pointer walking by, and I never saw him again. Like, and that was first off week of October, probably just cruising and following a hot doe. And, I didn't get him any other cameras. I think they just kind of travel so far of an area, and they're just kind of in and out of spots throughout the season, whether there's acorns in the area. Like I said, if you do find a cluster of oaks, or just when leaves drop, and it's just kind of changing their bedding patterns as well, just because of cover. I think there's just kind of a lot of different variables, and it's hard to really pinpoint exactly what kind of pattern to follow to get on one consistently.
Right. It's one of those areas where it's like, as I was scouting through, you know, where I think you have to be patient. Like, I'm usually relatively aggressive. But you know, I've learned my lesson in some other big woods where I need to be a little bit more patient, because I've screwed myself by being too aggressive. Right. Is that, so let me ask you that, like, what is your hunting style? I guess, are you like, do you hunt super mobile, or are you really aggressive, or are you more patient? Do you kind of pick your moments when you're going to try to kind of go in and hunt a deer? Like how do you kind of approach that?
I've been progressively getting more aggressive. I rarely will hunt from the same tree anymore. I may be in the same area, but I kind of stay mobile. I usually, like I said, with my work schedule, I'll go out like whenever I can. I don't, obviously if a cold front or anything like that comes, I try to make a priority to go out hunting, but I don't necessarily, wait for certain moments to go in. Like if you were going to ask me about kind of if I never put a stand up to kind of have like just to survey an area.
Well, an observation sit.
Yeah. There's no really point, I don't think, in this kind of habitat to do observation sits. I try to get right into where I think they're either coming out of or going towards, whether it's bedding or feeding. I kind of try to get that middle ground the best I can, but more focus on getting closer to the bedding than the feed.
Right. Yeah. Cause I mean, in an area like that, observation sits, you may only see that deer one time.
Yeah. So you better kill him if you see him. So.
Right. Right. It's not like one of those things where you're trying to lay the trap and then kind of like tighten the loop on him necessarily, because he may never be back. You know, that might be the only time he comes through that area or whatever the case is. So you've mentioned, you know, using cameras and stuff like that. Like, where are you setting cameras? Cause that's the one thing that for me, truthfully, it's like, as you and I are sitting here talking, I've been contemplating heading back up this weekend to get a little turkey hunt in and hang some cameras in some areas that I had found when I was previously scouting, and then do some additional scouting. But, you know, as I was kind of walking through, like, there were some, you know, scrapes that were pretty decent that had some licking branches where it looked like, okay, these might be used, you know, more year round than just during, you know, pre-rut and rut, you know, possibly. You know, there's that bed that I found that I was kind of interested in, and found plenty of doe bedding and stuff like that around some of these cuts and stuff like that. So I'm just curious, man, when you're setting up cameras, what are you typically setting cameras up on? Like, what's telling you to set a camera up? Cause the other thing is too, is, you know, there's not like a, you know, you don't find beaten down trails in these types of areas, because like, there's just so much land, like there's so much area. And because there's not a ton of topography and a lot of it's flat, like you mentioned, it's not like there's a bunch of like terrain features that are funneling deer into specific areas. You know what I mean? And so it's almost feels like they're nomadic. So it's like, how are you, what are you setting cameras up on to get your inventory?
So like you said, scrapes, if I find a scrape, like again, throughout the spring, I'm marking every scrape, but if I see something with like a really nice licking branch that's snapped off and a pretty fresh ground's kind of scraped away, I'm definitely putting a camera on that. I've had deer throughout the summer and into early fall, like consistently hitting those. Mm-hmm. So if you can find a scrape that you think is pretty active and it's being used more like sort of more of a community scrape kind of ordeal, mm-hmm. I would definitely put a camera on that. Like I said, if any of these like kind of secluded food plots, if they have clover or anything that's going to be attractive to deer, I'm going to put a camera on that, more so just to see kind of what's coming in feeding, mm-hmm. In the area. And then when you're getting close to those clear cuts, I'm looking for any kind of entrance and exit trails that, again, you may not see the beaten down trails, but right. when you're walking through it, you're going to know like they're coming in and out of this area. I'd also put cameras on that as well, just to kind of see if I can catch any buck moving in and out through there.
Right.
And it usually pays off. I usually have pretty good luck. Let's just say, like I said, I'm always, every year I have a list of bucks that I'm excited to try to shoot, and usually doesn't really come to fruition most years on getting them, but right. I can at least get them on camera.
So. Right. Yeah. There's one area around a cut, like it's a classic, like there's a ring around it that they're walking, and it's like, there's a cut, and then there's like a trail just on the inside of like that, just at the outside edge of that cut on the inside edge of mountain laurel. Right. So there's a cut and then mm-hmm. right into mountain laurel. And then right after that, it's a small oak flat. And I was like, that for me is kind of like probably like one of the best early season setups or areas that I found, because they're clearly traveling around that cut is going to be green and just like a banging food source for them throughout the summer and early part of fall, even shit through the winter with like the briar and stuff like that. And then you've got the acorns there. If they drop, like they're going to just be, you know, it'd be bananas, you know, like that area is just going to hold deer. And we've actually found some sheds in there too. So there were bucks that were kind of hanging out in there. And so that's the one area that I'm kind of thinking of. So to your point, it's like how they're getting in and out. That was kind of my first thought too, was that, okay, this cut, there's a big classic ring around it. They're obviously using this, probably a great place to inventory. Not quite sure how mm-hmm. I would hunt it, because the access into it would be kind of a little bit tough, but it was probably like the best early season setup I had. And then certainly those scrapes. I wanted to ask you, man, like one of the things that I've kind of noticed in some of these areas, and I'm just curious if it holds true here, because where I did find some of the sign was actually on like some like really small benches that you really didn't see much on the map. But when I walked mm-hmm. it was like, oh shit, I was like, it's starting to flatten out. And now there's like a bench here, and it was like, boom, scrape, you know? And so are you finding that they're using more benches to kind of get around and laying sign down on? Because that was where, like, I've noticed that in some other areas that I hunt, like they won't really run the tops too much, like on ridges. Now I know this area has big tops because you're on the top of a mountain, but it always just seemed like those little flat spot bench, like bench systems that you maybe don't even see on a map. They always seem to kind of be places where they congregate and lay down sign. Is that hold true for this area as well for you?
Yeah. Like I have two spots I can think of right now that are very nice bench areas that are going up these mountains. And I've found a great amount of sign, whether usually the wider parts of the wider benches is where I usually find the scrapes. Mm-hmm. Whereas the narrower ones, for whatever reason, I usually find more kind of bedding areas, whether it's just because they just feel a little bit safer kind of with the kind of close drop off. And then the kind of their backs a little bit, like some more against the ridge. Mm-hmm. I usually find better bedding in that kind of situation. But again, benches are kind of definitely a challenge to hunt based on kind of wind and where, how you're going to come in and approach them.
Yeah.
Because a lot of those times they're definitely the buck are sitting up pretty high on those mountains. So trying to hike up there and not really spook them is definitely going to be a challenge.
Right.
But yeah, I definitely, if you can find any kind of nice bench systems, you're going to find good deer sign. Again, right. Cause like I said, 75% of the tops are all kind of, just
flat
open, just kind of like flat, just, thick, nasty stuff that they're going to not really want to be
right.
spending a lot of time in. So,
yeah.
But yeah, like you said about that spot, I would definitely put a cluster of cameras kind of in that area, because you found a pocket of interest. And yeah. that's like how I would approach that, is definitely put like 3 or 4 cameras in that area. Just like you said, they're nomadic. They're not really following one straight trail in and out of these spots. So
right.
the more cameras you can have in that area to try to catch any kind of movement, the better.
Right. And do you run cameras year round, or do you just kind of run them through the season? What's your approach to that?
I put out 3 cameras. I usually start, like I said, at end of May, and then I'll run them up until, depending on if the spots that I have them in are pretty accessible to rifle hunters, I'll usually pull mm-hmm. them by the end of archery or kind of into early December, January, I'll take them out.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. It's about the same thing that I do, unless I have some really remote areas, then I'll leave them up year round. But anything that's somewhat accessible, yeah. I kind of pull mine too.
And I just buy those $28 Tasco cameras and try to stack up on it as much as I can. It's that because the cell phone service here is hit or miss. I'm not able to really to run any cell cameras or anything like that either.
Right, right. And so now I want to talk just a little bit about sign, because I want you to kind of paint a picture for me as far as like what good sign looks like in this area. Because I know you and I talked a little bit about what I was finding, you know, and, you know, I was thinking that it was good based on experiences and other kind of big woods pieces and stuff like that, but also was, you know, not 100% sure. Right. And so it was kind of fortuitous that you kind of, you know, pinged me on Instagram and, you know, and we're familiar with some of the stuff I was talking about. And I was like, perfect. I was like, so I'm not crazy. This is actually pretty decent. I'm not wasting my time. Yeah. So just talk to me a little bit about that. Like whenever you find a rub, like what's a good rub for you? What's a good scrape in this area in terms of like the sign that would get you excited?
So usually a good rub, the majority of rubs that I'm finding are like that I consider quote unquote a good rub is probably on trees that are baseball bat thick. Mm-hmm. usually I look for kind of how tall the rubs are. Like mm-hmm. I said, obviously a spiker is not going to be able to rub his antlers 24 inches to make a rub. Right. So any kind of rub that's just kind of decently tore up, kind of long in length. And then if it is a bigger tree and you do see kind of tine marks, obviously the that's a good indicator of a nicer buck. Right. I don't really find those big kind of hammer rubs or anything along those lines. I do have one area that for whatever reason there's no small rubs, and every rub I found is a hammer sized rub, so I'm not really quite sure how to make that out yet, and it's right. a new spot I'm gonna be hunting, so I don't really know what's in there, but maybe there's a 160 incher running around that's tearing all these trees up, but
right.
that's to be determined. So usually, like I said, if I find a cluster of rubs, I kind of will consider that good sign. I don't necessarily you can tell just from when you're sitting in a tree and you see during the rut and you see a little buck running by and just kind of half-assed just rubbing their antlers mm-hmm. on the tree and just keep on moving. You can tell kind of those rubs from more of a deer that's kind of has more testosterone and is working a tree. So
right.
rubs up. Like I said, are kind of I'm just looking for rubs. I don't necessarily need to see the biggest rub in the valley. I just want to know that there is a buck in there and he is trying to lay down some sign.
Right.
And then scrapes, usually I don't often find a lot of scrapes per se across the whole mm-hmm. area. Mm-hmm. But when I do find scrapes, I usually find 2 to 3 to 4 scrapes in kind of a maybe 200 yard radius. Usually it's around areas that I have more diversity regarding clear cuts and so forth. So
right.
I'm looking for any kind of scrape that's got a good looking branch that's been snapped and twisted around. And mm-hmm. I don't necessarily see like the what do you guys sometimes people call them, like the truck, dashboard,
like the car hood, car hood. Yeah, size.
Yeah, the car. Yeah, I'm never really finding like a car hood size scrape or anything like that. But like I said, I'm just happy to find consistent deer sign, like rub, scrapes, scat. I like looking for droppings that are big in size. When mm-hmm. when I was out in Colorado, I kind of realized this thing. I'm like, well, I'm finding these droppings that are huge, and I'm like, well, obviously, like I'm chasing a deer that's bigger than a whitetail. And right. I just kind of associated bigger droppings with a bigger deer. Not necessarily a bigger rack, but if I find good sized droppings larger than your common deer scat, I'm definitely paying attention to that. So
right.
There's nothing really in particular, one sign that I'm looking at that's saying, all right, this is going to be the winning spot. I'm looking kind of for a good mix of everything in an area is what I like to find.
Right. And that was the one thing that I realized, you know, when you and I were kind of texting back and forth and stuff, was like all the stuff you just mentioned, I found in that one area. And it was probably within roughly 200 yards. And those scrapes were, there were three all together, like in one spot, literally like right beside each other, like one, two, three. On three different trees, like in a row. And then that was actually, that tied into that bench that I had mentioned. And then when I got into that bench, there was like a rub there. And then there were like two more scrapes there. And that was maybe only like 75 yards away. And then if you went the opposite direction, that was where I picked up like a cluster of rubs and then down along the edge of this cut. And it was probably like 200 yards away or whatever, like a couple, you know, rubs along the way. It might be a little further than that. Anyway, it wasn't a ridiculous distance. And then it was like, I picked up that rub line and into that bed. Right. And so that was what kind of told me, like going back to what you were saying, like marking all these things, and you can kind of see how they all start to tie together. And that was whenever I went back and I looked at the map and I was like, oh man, I was like, all these things kind of like all run together. Right. I was like, it's this loop that's happening. Cause there was some other sign that I found up, I think it was up top on, above the clear cut. And I was like, this deer's just kind of like using this general area. You know what I mean? I was like, cause it all kind of feels like it's, you know, maybe not the same deer, but it's like, it's all in the same general area where it would make sense that that's how a deer would travel. Right.
Yeah.
So, which was kind of cool to hear that from you, because I just wasn't sure how this stuff was all kind of coming together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing, man. It's like whenever you're in a new area hunting, it's like whatever you can do to try to meet folks that are from that area to kind of tell you what kind of sign you're looking at. You know what I mean? Cause like me living there, not ever having talked to you, it's like, I probably would have been like, man, scouting was really kind of a bust. Like I haven't really found a whole lot that I'm willing to go set cameras on or anything like that. You know what I mean? But after talking to you, I'm like, okay, yeah, I need to set cameras on that and see what's doing in that general area. So that's,
I think you'd be pleasantly surprised when you do put cameras out and do see, like I said, you may not get 200, 300, 400 pictures on your camera when you run and put them all somewhere out. Right. But if you get 50 pictures and you get 10 pictures of a nice buck cruising, you're gonna be happy, because like I said, a lot like that old timer said to you, like, you don't see a lot of buck up there, but when you do see one, it could be the biggest buck you've ever shot.
Right.
So it's just that vast of territory, and I don't really think it gets pressure, but I don't think a lot of buck get pulled out of the area.
Mm-hmm.
That there's definitely some deer in there that probably have never even come across a human that are living back in there.
Yeah. And that was kind of the sense that I got too, is that the deer that are in there get an opportunity to get some age on them. Right. It's kind of the same thing when you get out to like the Alleghenies where some of my buddies hunt. It's, you know, it's Pennsylvania, but there's people pulling hammers out of there because it's just a vast area. And some of these deer are getting, you know, aging to like 6 years old, where they're reaching their maturity, you know, their full potential, whatever that is, you know what I mean? Like they're hitting that. So they, you know, you're getting good caliber deer just based on the age of them essentially. But speaking of good caliber deer, man, you know, I know I've held you here for a little over an hour. I want to be sensitive to your time, but you know, I want to talk about this deer that you killed this year, man. Cause I know when we were chatting, you sent me a picture of the buck that you killed up in this, you know, general area, and it's a hammer. And so I kind of want to hear, that was kind of one of the things, like, you said, like, hey man, you know, I'm not familiar 100% with exactly where I'm at, but you're from the area, you know, and you were like, hey, I heard you were up in the Northeast and just wanted to say, hey, you know, there are some decent deer up here. And you sent me the picture, and I was like, all right, sold. I was like, I'm going to definitely spend some time. not to say that I don't have some decent ones around here, cause I definitely chased some good ones last year here, but you know, it's like, I'm always looking to try to find other pockets of areas. So I just want to hear how this kind of hunt and how this deer all kind of came together. So did you know of this deer before you killed it? Did you have trail camera pictures of it? Like, did you know he was alive, or was it just kind of like a random thing?
Yeah. So this deer, actually, I got on camera, I think it was, I went back actually in this area. It was a new spot for me last year that I went back in April and kind of scouted around a little bit. Found some, I went back on this trail. It probably was about a little over a mile and a half to get back there. And it was, there was multiple, fields and one of them had fresh clover growing in it. So I'm like, oh, this looks nice. And I found multiple scrapes around the perimeter. I found a nice actual signpost rub that I did find in that spot. So I'm like, okay, I'll have to come back here. So I did go back, probably May to June, and I did put a camera out, and, I think it was July when I went back and checked it, because usually I wait about a month or so and I'll go in and check them just to make sure they're working appropriately and mm-hmm. see if anything hits it. And I was the first camera pull, I was shocked. Like for these areas, like you don't, like, if you see 2 to 3 deer together, it's like, oh, that's a lot of deer in one camera. But I pulled this camera and I had, I think it was 10 to 12 different deer feeding in this clover plot. I'm like, oh my God, like that's probably every deer in a 30 mile radius that's feeding in this area.
Right.
So, and then actually as I was flipping through, I get this daylight photo. It was around like, I don't know, 7-ish in the evening of this huge mainframe. What was he? A 10 point that, just was had thick mass on him come into this plot. And in July, like he had his frame out, but I could just see the start of a drop time for me on the one side. I'm like, oh man, this is too good to be true. So I left that camera on that spot throughout the summer. And after that, every photo I got was evening photos. And actually there was about like maybe 4 or 5 different buck. There was one other nice one. I think actually was probably body wise just seemed a little bit older, than this one. But so I had camera pictures of them, coming in. So then in end of July into August, I'm like, well, I got to kind of figure out where he's coming from. So, I kind of started backtracking and went up this ridge where, cause every photo I got of him was coming from this left side, which there's this ridge up on the left side. So I followed that up and it was kind of a hemlock mixed with some oak trees. And, of course it wasn't really a good acorn, crop for us this year. But I followed that up and, it kind of turned into some hemlocks and I found a scrape up there kind of close to the top. So I put a camera on the scrape. I went back and checked it in August. And, sure enough, when I checked it in August, end of August, I had a picture of him coming in and, hitting that licking branch and working the scrape. So I'm like, oh, I'm getting closer. So I went back and I really didn't get much photos of him in September. I got him around like 5 a.m. I kind of put more cameras around the perimeter of the plots and everything and pulled some cameras off because at that point, like September is usually the archery hunters are kind of coming in and also setting up cameras. And the fact that it was over a plot, I didn't want it to get stolen.
Right.
So I got another picture around 5 a.m. I went back there the first day of archery. I think it was October 3rd was our first day of archery. Mm-hmm. I hunted kind of right close by to that scrape. All I saw was a small bear that day, no deer at all. So, I'm like, okay, like it's going to be one of these seasons again, where I kind of try to chase a deer that I usually never have luck targeting a buck that I get on cameras that I ended up killing in the fall. So I didn't want to fall into that pattern. There was like between the whole, all my cameras that I had out, there was maybe 3 or 4 different buck that I considered shooters, maybe 3-year-old 120 class deer that I'd be happy to shoot.
Right.
So I kind of didn't want to get my hopes high in this one. So I came back, next was on the Thursday, it was October 8th. And at this point we had a slight drop in temperature, a little cold front came by. I think it was about 8 degrees colder than what it had been the prior couple of days. So I usually mountain bike back into the spot. So I mountain bike back there. This time, most of the pictures, like I said, he was coming off the left side, off this ridge, but occasionally I get photos of him coming from the right side. So I did kind of a big loop. I have, I use it like a lock-on stand and sticks, mm-hmm. but all that, plus my Western frame pack just to have as well in case I got something to quarter and everything. So I hiked around, did a big loop. I ended up bumping 2 doe, and I circled up and around these food plots. And then I kind of started coming on the other side of that ridge where I had the picture of him and the scrape. And I ended up bumping another buck and a doe, and they kind of ran across and down. So down below was kind of, maybe a couple of years ago, there was a storm and it blew a bunch of trees down. So it's all down trees and kind of new growth and grasses and everything like that growing up below it. So I'm like, okay, like if I was a deer, I'd be bedded down in here. So where I kind of had that camera, it was kind of right below a saddle. So I kind of set up on the other side of this saddle. There was no scrapes. There was no rubs. If it wasn't for me bumping those deer and just saying like, all right, like I don't want to keep on pushing forward in case those deer do swing around in the evening. I just set up randomly, I thought, in the spot. So I set up in the tree, and then probably it was the last half hour of light. I just happened to look down below me out of that thick cover of the grass and everything. And I see brown of a deer working its way up. I wasn't sure if like what it was at that point. And I didn't want to get my hopes up. So just continue to sit there. It starts working its way up closer. At that point, I pulled my binos and I just immediately see the drop time. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like he's here. Cause like I said, that usually never happens for me. So he works his way up and he's coming straight on a line right up towards me. He ends up kind of coming, I think he was actually going to come up and kind of cross right in between that saddle and kind of go where that maybe hit the scrape and then work his way back to those fields to feed in. Cause I was about a little over half a mile back from those plots that I had pictures of him in the summer.
Right.
So he ends up coming like right up towards me, and it was almost like an old quad trail or something. It just was a little opening, and he steps out and he's within under 12 yards of me. And it was a hard like quartering two shot, and I hit him high up, and the arrow just kind of buried in him, but it didn't come out. And he immediately turned and like took off straight down the ridge. And I ended up calling my one buddy, Tim, and he was like 45 minutes away hunting somewhere else. He drove out. And then my dad was, I had him on the other side of the game lands, and kind of met up and went back in again and hiked down to where I last saw him. And it was a tough blood trail because of how that arrow was angled, and it just, there was no blood really to come out. It was all kind of up top. So any kind of like higher leaves, I'd see a little specks of blood. So
right.
He ended up being 200 yards down that ridge from where I shot him at. And you always think, I'm like, okay, like I'm so far back. Like I was probably at least 2 miles back when all said and done. And if I go down below me, and when I came back in October later in the month to scout and look around that area, and there's literally a hang on stand 100 yards from where that deer died. That must have come off the private piece. So it's like you think you're out in the middle of nowhere, and then you find another tree stand or human sign. So all in all, like we ended up having to quarter it there because I was so far back, and I think I put 8 miles on total that day. Jeez. And thankfully I had the frame pack and got him out. So he ends up scoring, I think he was just shy of like 134 inches.
Nice. Yeah. He's a great deer, man. And his mass too is just like stupid mass on that deer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny. Cause when I saw the picture of him, like I saw, I think you sent me like the score or something like that. And I was like, or maybe I read it on your Instagram page or something like that. And I was like, man, there's no way it's gotta be bigger than that. Cause just like looking at his mass was just like, it was just ridiculous. Yeah, I mean, it's the size of a beer bottle. Like, and he carries,
yeah, it really is.
Yeah. And it's like, and I'm saying that because you sent me a picture of like his skull cap next to a beer bottle. And it's like, it's legit. That was actually
a wine bottle.
A wine bottle. Jeez. That's even, yeah. I mean, it's like, and he carries it all the way out. Like, it's like, that was in between like the G2 and the G3, right? If I'm not mistaken, it's like, and he carries his mass all the way out, which is crazy.
Yeah. It was incredible. And like I said, I didn't age the tooth or anything like that. I didn't send it out, but just looking at it, I'd be hard pressed to put him at 4 years old. Like he may only have been a 3.5 year old buck,
right.
Which is crazy too as well. But, I usually don't hold my standards up that high. Like if I can shoot 120 inch respectable buck on these game lands, I'd be happy every year. But yeah, he's definitely an incredible deer for the area. So I can't be more pleased with him.
Yeah, for sure, man. Well, he's a killer deer, man. And, a killer story. It's cool that you actually had pictures of him early and kind of figured him out, you know, or knew kind of the area that he was kind of hanging out in, and you just kind of made the right choice. I mean, when you said you were a half mile off that food, you know, I mean, that's like, as soon as you said that, I was like, oh man, that's probably like classic staging area. Like that's probably where he's staging, You know what I mean? Like that's the spot he's coming out to as he's making his way toward that. He's just going to kind of kick it there for a little while until he gets some cover of dark, because he's probably not. Well, obviously he was there in daylight, so he's not far from bed at that point. You know what I mean? Like, I'd be curious. Have you gone back and looked at the map to see like the direction he was coming from, like where the likely bedding would be that he was spending time in, because since he got there with daylight left?
Yeah, so I walked all through that bottom section and everything, and it's hard because it's not classic deer bedding that you'd think of. It's just literally just a pile of blowdowns, and there were some tree roots and everything like that were kind of flipped over. And I honestly think he was just bedding on one of those little spots there, and just kind of at that point, like he just nobody would go through that area, and I think that's why made it attractive for that spot. And I'm going to be curious this year when I go back, and I'm going to hunt again close by that area and see if another mature deer has kind of taken that area as his own, and see if there's anything hanging out down there. I'll probably put a camera, like get a little more aggressive and put it kind of real close to that bedding area and see what happens. But again, I took my buddies back there in that spot, and like, they're like, wait, this is where you shot the deer? Like if you went by that spot, you would just keep on going. There was really nothing that would draw you to say like, let's hunt here. Like there's no rubs, no scrapes, nothing really sign wise that was outstanding. But I think said maybe just the terrain features, and just kind of thankfully getting photos of him throughout the summer, and kind of just getting closer and closer to the daylight photos of him, and just trying to piece that together, I think was the biggest factor in me getting a shot on him.
So. Well, that, and I think you hit the nail on the head, I think, with one of the first things you said, which is like, you know, some people, you know, and I'm guilty of it too, I think most people are, you get enamored with sign, you get enamored with topo and, you know, terrain features and reading maps and stuff like that, which are all like should be used and are valuable, but still at the end of the day, a big mature deer, what he wants more than anything is to be left alone. Right. Yep. So it's like, where's the area where he can be left alone and be safe, and not just left alone from people, but left alone from other deer, you know? And so you find those little pockets, you know, that's where they're going to spend time. Right. And then if you can find terrain and stuff like that to kind of help them get to and from that makes sense, that, you know, that benefit them, then that's just like the icing on the cake. But at the end of the day, they just want away from people, and they want away from other deer, especially once they go hard horned and start to kind of get ready for rut.
And I think the biggest piece of advice I can give people is just the scouting. It's just so important just to kind of get familiar with the area that you're hunting, because these animals call this their home. Like they know it better than we'll ever know it. So you got to kind of put as much effort into learning with their home just to have a better chance of getting a shot on one.
Yeah, exactly. Well, awesome, man. I appreciate you coming on, buddy. Before I let you get going, let people know where they can find out more about you and follow along with any of your outdoor excursions this year.
Yeah, so usually I'm most active on Instagram, and it's TRunsCav is where you can find me at. So hopefully everyone has a good spring scouting and a good fall coming up.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, man, I appreciate you coming on and spending some time with me. And I think you and I are going to spend some time talking here in the not so distant future, on and off, as I get more familiar with some of these areas. Sound good?
Yep. Sounds good, man.
Awesome, brother. Appreciate you. All right, folks, that is a wrap for today's show. I'd like to thank all of you for listening. And if you haven't yet, please head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star rating. And hell, while you're at it, head over to YouTube and give us a sub there too. I'd be super appreciative if you'd be able to do those two things for me. And before I shut this thing down, I need to give a big shout out to our partners who continue to help us make this podcast possible: Tethered, Exodus Outdoor Gear, Skull Brew Coffee Company, and Maven Optics. And until next time, we'll see y'all. All right, gang, the new Truth merch is in stock at truthfromthestand.com and on YouTube below any of the Truth from the Stand videos. I've got some new hats, beanies, t-shirts, long sleeve t-shirts, and sweatshirts. There's even a new do hard shit hat for those of us who like to embrace microdosing adversity. So head to truthfromthestand.com and check out the new gear, and use the code TRUTH, T-R-U-T-H, and save yourself some cash on the new gear.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew here at Duck Camp Dinners. every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. Birds up in the sky.